Bigfoot and Teton sat at the terminus of the canyon, 4 or 5 miles apart. Teton was south of the river and above it. It would be spared, barely. Wilford was just north of the river at bank elevation. A few miles beyond Wilford was Sugar City, and 6 miles farther down was Rexburg, a community of 8,000 people. Another 60 river miles beyond was Idaho Falls, population 35,776, the third largest town in Idaho. All four towns were going to absorb a direct hit, but none would be hit like Wilford. When road atlases were republished a year later, Wilford would not be listed among Idaho's cities and towns. The leading wave arrived 25 minutes after the dam broke. It was 20 feet high. The fastest egress to safety was the road north to St. Anthony, even though it went straight across the plain and sight of the river for 3 miles before it began to climb. As the last refugees from Wilford roared up the highway in their cars, they could see the flood approaching out of the east. It looked like a dust storm, until they saw the dust snapping huge cottonwoods in half. One of the first homes hit was Alice Birch's. The day before, she had celebrated living in the same house for 50 years. The 20-foot wall crashed into it, tore it off its foundations, and lifted it onto a power line, which snapped in half. The shooting voltage ignited a ruptured propane tank, and Alice Birch's house blew to smithereens. Glenn Bedford's aging parents-in-law, the Leadings, lived in Wilford. When the first radio announcements about the dam came around 10 o'clock, he raced up to their house from Parker on the Henry's Fork of the Snake to help them get out. Roaring by his sister-in-law's home in St. Anthony, 5 miles before Wilford, Glenn Bedford saw his mother-in-law already unloading a pickup with a few belongings. Her husband was nowhere in sight. Believing that he was still at home in Wilford, Bedford drove his foot into the accelerator pedal. His father-in-law, who had been behind the house and out of view, read Bedford's mind and roared off after him. When he got to Wilford, he could already see the flood pouring out of the canyon. "From a mile and a half away," he said, "it looked 50 feet high." When Leading caught up with his son-in-law at his house, he screamed at him to turn back to St. Anthony. "I'll be there in 4 minutes," Bedford yelled, and ran upstairs to collect a last armload of valuables and mementos. They found him 11 days later, twisted almost beyond recognition, amid a pile of trees and torn-up trailers. Wilford went in an instant. The flood left only the 2-story Mormon meeting house, and of that it left only the brick shell. The other 154 houses were intact or in pieces, riding the 15-mile-an-hour crest. As the flood swept southwestward, it spread to a width of 2 miles, but it had enough churning power to strip the topsoil off thousands of acres of first-class farmland. When it hit Sugar City, the flood was no longer liquid, but semi-solid. There was a trailer park outside of Sugar City, and according to witnesses in airplanes overhead, the flood hit town, tumbling trailers like ice cubes, smashing houses off their foundations. Like Wilford, Sugar City was motionless 1 minute and moving 15 miles an hour the next. Somehow, one of the victims there was killed by a shotgun blast. In their desperation to flee Sugar City, Betty and Rodney Larson flooded their car's engine so badly that it wouldn't start. With the flood bearing down on them, it was too late to escape on foot. They ran upstairs with their 3 children and draped themselves over mattresses, hoping they would float. For 3 hours, their house felt as if a turbine generator were rattling itself loose in their basement. The house eventually came right off its foundation, but miraculously it did not move. Like a dud missile, it floated 2 feet off its pad and settled back down exactly where it had been. To pass the time, they counted dead cows. Since 11 o'clock in the morning, the Rexburg police and civil defense had been herding people to higher ground. The Rexburg benchlands rise up from the eastern edge of the town, and on top of the first hill stood Mormon Ricks College, its dormitories recently emptied. 7,000 people streamed up College Hill like the Hebrews during the Exodus, dragging whatever cars, wheelbarrows, and muscle could carry. By the time the flood hit Rexburg, the radio said, the crest would be only 2 to 4 feet deep. They saw the dust first, a 4-mile-wide roiling cloud, then they saw the wall of water. It came just like a lava flow. 5 feet in front of it, everything was dry, and then came the wave 7 feet high. Just before it hit town, the radio station went dead. The first thing the wave hit was the lumberyard outside of town. All the logs, thousands of them, were set loose. Dozens of them smashed against the bulk gasoline storage tank a few hundred yards away. The tank went off like a firebomb, setting flaming slicks adrift on the racing water. When the wave hit the front line of houses, 100 windows were instantaneously shattered. Witnesses said it sounded just like a rifle shot. Then the flaming gasoline poured into windows and set Rexburg on fire like a floating island desert. The throng on College Hill watched speechlessly as the wall of water washed their town away, burning it down as it went. A big white frame house floated over to the base of the hill below them and settled down in shallow water in the middle of a street. The water itself, moving only 10 miles an hour now, but engorged with a cubic quarter mile of topsoil, had force enough to separate homes from their foundations. But the real damage to Rexburg was done by Sugar City and Wilford. Reduced to giant pieces of flotsam, silos, walls, automobiles, telephone poles, pianos, trees, Wilford and Sugar City were a battering ram afloat, smashing Rexburg to pieces. When the flood passed after dusk, it had left 6 inches of silt on everything, as if it had snowed mud. A Greyhound bus sat on someone's lawn. 100 miles downriver on the Snake was American Falls Reservoir, holding 4 times as much water as Teton had held. American Falls was one of the Bureau's oldest dams. The dam was, in fact, unsafe, something the Bureau knew as early as 1966, but hadn't bothered to correct. In 1967, Chief Engineer Barney Belport wrote Floyd Dominey that the need for replacement of American Falls Dam is largely governed by structural reasons, although the deterioration of the concrete due to alkali aggregate reaction contributes to the poor condition of the structure. The lack of bond between constriction joints and the fact that the dam was not designed for ice pressures are of great significance. By 1976, however, the dam had been neither replaced nor fixed. If the dam was too weak to withstand the strain of the Teton flood coming on top of high flows in the Snake, the resulting calamity could only be guessed at. Instead of spreading out, the water would remain largely confined by the canyon of the Snake until it hit the Boise. Below, beyond Hell's Canyon, the dams were lined up like dominoes. Ice Harbor, Little Goose, Lower Granite, Lower Monumental. Then the Columbia River and McNary, the Dalles, John Day, and Bonneville dams. The bigger Columbia dams would have seen such a flood before, perhaps, but those on the Snake, unless the reservoirs could be emptied in time, might meet flows they were never designed to handle. There was only one course of action, empty American Falls. Over 2 days, the archaic dam would have to release more water than it ever had before, and its reservoir would receive more at one time than it ever got. By nightfall on Saturday, Rexburg was a silhouette of wreckage, carnage, and flaring fires. The lower half of the town was a total loss. As Rexburg finally became a vast, slowly shrinking pool of standing water, the flood was washing up against the Menin Buttes, some low hills off to the west. Now 6 miles wide, it split suddenly into 2 streams. The one veering northward around the buttes struggled upward against the inclined plain and fell back into a channel it quickly dug down to bedrock. Within minutes, it was a replica of the chocolate-brown Colorado River at high water. Then, beyond the buttes, the 2 channels rejoined, and the flood went into Idaho Falls. 2 things saved Idaho Falls. One was the geologic bedrock and soil which had made Teton such a bad project, physically and economically. By the time the flood poured itself into the Snake River 20 miles above the town, a lot of it had drained off into the porous soil and deeply fractured bedrock beneath it. The other salvation was a night and a day spent by thousands of volunteers sandbagging the levees along the river, which goes through the dead center of town. The flood built toward a crest all day Sunday, and finally peaked at just over 100,000 cubic feet per second at 10 o'clock at night. As logs, fiberboard, and bales of hay crashed up against the Broadway Bridge, which retained only inches of freeboard, a reservoir began to form behind it. 9 pounds of dynamite and a 60-foot drag line could not dislodge the debris. It was only after an escape channel was dug that officials decided they wouldn't have to blow up the bridge. It survived, looking as if it had been chewed by a 100-foot shark. The town escaped with 200 flooded homes. At American Falls Dam, water was bursting furiously out of the outlet works. 10,000 Bureau people and 3 million more downstream, all the way to the Pacific, held their collective breath as the reservoir began to fill early Monday morning. But the remains of the flood did not even overtop the spillway. 11 people died in the Teton flood, but the dam could just as easily have gone at 2 in the morning, in which case the toll could have risen into the thousands. Power and telephone lines between Sugar City and Rexburg were cut as soon as the flood struck, so the odds are there would have been no warning. The Bureau had installed no sensors below the dam to warn the towns if a flood was on the way. 4,000 homes were damaged or destroyed. 350 businesses were lost. Damage estimates climbed to $2 billion, though settlements were to fall substantially short of that. Nothing, however, was as startling as what the flood had done to the land. The topsoil was gone from tens of thousands of acres, stripped off as if a plow a mile and a half wide had come along, scraping the earth down to bedrock. According to one estimate, more land was destroyed, permanently, made incapable of ever growing anything again, than would have been open to irrigation by the dam. That was merely the first in a long string of ironies that followed in the wake of the tragedy. As it turned out, the farmers on the Rexburg bench, the rich irrigators for whose benefit the dam was mainly built, were entirely spared. Their river-bottom neighbors, whose means of livelihood vanished with the flood, would have to search the region, the state, even the country to find a decent farm they could afford with their settlement money. But the farmers on the Rexburg bench could relax. They may not even miss the water they would now never receive. A lot of wells have been drilled up on the bench, explained Agriculture Commissioner Bill Kellogg, confirming what the dam's opponents had been saying all along, and the dam was only intended for supplemental water. The same supplemental water, a life-or-death matter 3 days before, had suddenly become something they could do without. The dam's opponents had argued that, too. But even had the irrigators on the benchlands been ruined for want of water, there were only a handful of them. There were thousands of victims on the floodplain below. The politicians who had fought hardest for Teton Dam, such as Frank Church, were the first to pounce on the Bureau after the dam failed, the first to search the disaster for whatever political refuge could be found. Church castigated the Bureau for being a prisoner of stale engineering ideas. He made no apology for the stalest idea of all, the congressional pork barrel. "No one told me the dam was going to break," Church blustered when the local people, most of whom had wanted the dam as badly as he, tried to hold him responsible. Actually, Bob Curry had suggested just that to him 3 years earlier, when he wrote Church about the geologic defects of the site. Curry claims he never got a decent response. As for the Bureau, it said as little as it could. Its reputation suddenly in shambles, it tried not to make a wretched situation worse. Its press releases after the catastrophe were a dry recitation of events. They were honest, but there was no hint of responsibility, not even sympathy for the flood's victims, and no suggestion that perhaps the dam shouldn't have been built. None of Teton's principal designers and builders were fired. Harold Arthur voluntarily retired. He had reached retirement age anyway, and started up a lucrative consulting business in Denver. Though he never publicly entertained a doubt about the dam, though he approved every major decision during its construction, though he vetoed a plan to install 3 grout curtains instead of 1, not once during the interviews in 1982 and 1984 did Arthur display a hint of remorse. "One minute I hear the dam is fine, and the next minute it's failed," Arthur told me. "There wasn't anything I could do about it." Donald Duck was twice passed over for promotion and moved to Chicago, where he became a vice president of the Harza engineering firm, which builds dams. Robbie Robison drifted off and disappeared. In 1984, no one seemed to have any idea where he was. Commissioner Gil Stamm was, always, wooden as a cigar store Indian. "I ran into Stamm in Washington after the dam went," his old friend Floyd Dominey said. "I said to him, 'Jesus Christ, haven't you committed suicide yet?' He just smiled," said Dominey. "He just smiled." To this day, no one is exactly sure what caused the collapse of Teton Dam, though several million dollars were spent on four independent investigations to figure it out. It might have been a leaky joint between the foundation and the dam. It might have been a flaw in the impervious core of the dam itself. It might have been poor filler material. It might have been expansion and contraction caused by ice that formed during winter construction. The theory Harold Arthur maintained is incredible, virtually impossible, that water drifted around the grout curtain on the right side and immediately went back into the dam, turning it to mud, is the one that one former Bureau engineer, who would rather not be named, believes is the likeliest explanation. With the other theories, you can blame it on the contractors, he says. With the grout curtain theory, you're saying it was a lousy design, but that's why it failed. All the other theories are so much BS. However, among all the ironies that piled up in the aftermath of the Teton tragedy, everything pales besides one. There are a lot of voices in Idaho calling for the dam to be rebuilt. When a plague of locusts struck Utah after the first Mormons arrived, huge flocks of migrating seagulls flew in and ate them up. When clouds of disease-ridden flies and mosquitoes appeared in the wake of the Teton debacle, the same thing happened again. So the Mormon Irrigation Confederacy of Southern Idaho has apparently decided that God, all evidence to the contrary notwithstanding, is still on its side. On December 10, 1976, only half a year after the disaster, the Idaho Water Users Association issued a resolution calling for a safe Teton Dam to be rebuilt at or near the same site. Harold Arthur still believes he could design a dam at the Teton site that would not collapse, though no one seems inclined to let him try. His suggestion, offered in muted tones, comes as close to an apology as anything he said. The economics of the project are worse than ever, and with so much of the arid West screaming for more projects, projects that for whole regions are really a matter of life or death, at least if irrigation is to continue, it would be hard to justify an irrigation project for farmers still putting 10 feet of water on their land. None of this is to suggest, however, that the tragedy of Teton Dam might not be repeated somewhere else, Colorado, for example. Flowing through Denver, the South Platte River appears so insignificant it is hard to believe it is the city's main water supply, let alone the sustenance of hundreds of thousands of irrigated acres downstream in Colorado and Nebraska. The South Platte is a mere fork of the main Platte, itself a tributary of the Missouri, itself a child of the Father of Waters. From a plane climbing up from Stapleton Airport, the South Platte is seen to meander forlornly out of town until it is quickly swallowed, as everything is, by the surreal endlessness of the Great Plains. Viewed from a low bluff 200 miles downriver, it still appears of no consequence. The bottomlands are a tangle of shrubs and barbed wire interspersed with cottonwoods, and they are grazed bare by cows, which stare uncomprehendingly from the muck. It is a river without pretensions, haggard and used-looking, like a bag lady. In August, near the Nebraska border, the river dries up completely. All that reaches Nebraska is the underground flow. The Platte is one of the most hungrily used rivers in the entire world, surpassing even the Colorado. However, as far as the state of Colorado is concerned, it is not used enough. The South Platte is one of two rivers left in Colorado that isn't utterly and irrevocably appropriated, now and forever. To a state which is second to California in the arid West in population, industry, and irrigated acreage, but which has at its disposal about one-tenth as much water, the fact that some 7% of its share of the river still escapes to Nebraska is a fact of overarching significance. that the Bureau of Reclamation has offered to build an enormous dam across it to attempt to correct that situation is another. This last glimmering promise, in the face of a hopeless, non-negotiable finality, has been enough to lead the members of Colorado's political establishment into a world of fantasy, leaving both their senses and their principles behind. Don Christensen's crew cut stands up about an inch and a half, like a brush. A 300-pound bear could nest down in that hair for the night, and in the morning after the bear lumbered off, it would spring right back up. The rest of Christensen fits the hairstyle. He is lean, weathered, bronzed as a Comanche. His jaw is made of cast iron. The one anomaly in his all-American countenance is a thick, voluptuous set of lips. In 1979, at the annual Conference on Rivers and Water Policy in Washington, D.C., better known as the Dam Fighters Conference, Christensen, surrounded by long-hairs, environmental lawyers, bureaucrats, and kayakers, stood out like the man from Mars. Christensen's presence at the Dam Fighters Conference was a signal event. Unofficially, he was the first verifiable irrigation farmer who had ever attended the conference. He was probably one of the first who had ever opposed a dam, but he had a good reason. The Bureau of Reclamation, having nearly run out of decent dam sites, had finally decided to turn the Reclamation Act inside out. It was going to flood out a bunch of small farmers so it could give supplemental water to a bunch of bigger farmers, several of whom would be in violation of the Reclamation Act. Christensen was one of the small farmers, and he was the one with the biggest mouth. So the Bureau wanted to drown him with a vengeance. When Don Christensen's father settled in the Weldon Valley in 1926, there was already talk of a big dam at the narrows of the South Platte, 4 or 5 miles downstream from his land. The first serious proposal seems to have emerged in 1908. The farm, the whole town of Weldona, and everything else from bluff to bluff for 13 miles was to go under. But the elder Christensen refused to let the prospect faze him. Dad would tell us, maybe they're going to build it, maybe they're not going to build it. Maybe they're going to build it, but they're not going to build it for 30 years. I'm not going to sit here and let the goddamn government worry me to death. We're going to farm our land and live a normal life and keep our property up, and to hell with them. His prophecy was remarkable. Finally authorized in 1944 as one of 300-odd projects in the Pick Sloan Act, the Narrows project had still not been built 40 years later. The senior Christensen's attitude managed to infect all three of his sons, who raise their crops, paint their houses, fix their equipment, and otherwise carry on as if the threat of a dam did not exist. The same cannot be said, however, for the Weldon Valley as a whole. Weldona has the look of a town losing hope, houses unpainted, shutters askew, eerily quiet. The people who've just decided to let their old house decay may be the smart ones, Christensen says bitterly. Why spend $15,000 to fix up your property when you know the Bureau of Reclamation, he pronounces it Bureau, is going to tell you your house is a slum anyway when they make you an offer? The Weldon Valley was settled in the 1870s, only 40 years before the first proposal for a Narrows Dam. For most of its existence, it has been threatened with extinction. Any day, any hour, someone might appear on one's front lawn to survey. Someone might amble up one's walk with a sheaf of papers and an offer to sign, or else. It is bad enough to live like this. It is worse to live under the shadow of a project as nonsensical as a Narrows Dam. And it becomes almost ludicrous if there is a distinct possibility that the dam, once built, may not hold water and could conceivably collapse, rendering 75 years of worry, agony, and divisiveness for naught. This has been Don Christensen's fate since the day he was born. The dam will be immense, an earthen monster, 22,400 feet long. It would stretch, if laid across Washington, D.C., which is where Christensen suggests it ought to be built, from outer Georgetown to the Capitol. In New York, it would stretch from the Empire State Building to the Staten Island Ferry. For all its length, it would be only 147 feet high, and the reservoir behind it would be drawn down much of the time, which has prompted its critics to rename the project the Shallows. How anything this monumental, one of the largest dams on Earth, longer even than the main dam of Itaipu, longer than Fort Peck, could be built for $226 million, the official cost estimate as of 1980, is anyone's guess. Actually, a great part of that expenditure, probably half, wouldn't even be used to build the dam. It would go to 844 landowners to pay compensation for the 95 farms, 28 businesses, 2 churches, and elementary school that would be put underwater. It would also be used to relocate 26 miles of the Union Pacific's track and 20 miles of State Route 144. The remainder of the money would somehow erect a 4-mile-long dam. The Narrows Reservoir would submerge 14,000 to 17,000 acres of productive, privately irrigated farmland, none of which has ever received the kind of subsidy the beneficiaries of Narrows would automatically get. This is some of the oldest continuously irrigated land in the West. The Weldon Valley Ditch was dug by human and horse muscle in 1881. Another 40,000 acres of unirrigated grazing land would also be drowned or affected. Some local waterfowl habitat would be harmed, but the real damage to nature would be downstream. Flows in the hugely depleted South Platte, which are already critically low for the 750,000 ducks and geese and the migrating whooping and sandhill cranes, the entire surviving U.S. population of whoopers, for which the river is a crucial feeding and resting spot, would be further reduced. Although the amount of water diverted would not be much, for a dam of such size and cost it would be pathetic, its absence would be sorely felt by the waterfowl. On top of this, the concentration of fertilizers, pesticides, and sewage, Denver's and Fort Collins's, in the river would become worse. The main benefit of building Narrows, on the other hand, would be supplemental irrigation water for 287,000 acres of land downstream from Don Christensen's farm, most of it between the towns of Brush and Sterling. There would only be enough water for inches per acre, and one could reasonably question whether during the occasional severe drought whose ravages Narrows is supposed to make less severe, so little water would do any real good. In fact, the continued profitability of the farms making up those 287,000 acres through dry years and wet ones makes me wonder why the water is needed at all. The other benefits claimed for Narrows are recreation and flood control. The High Plains are home to some of the most freakish and violent weather in the world. Once, in Spearfish, South Dakota, thermometers leaped from 2 below to 38 above zero in 2 minutes. A rutting ground for Canadian and Caribbean airflows, the plains are also known as Tornado Alley. Something like 90% of the world's tornadoes occur in North America, most of them between the Rockies and the Mississippi River. A much more frequent natural phenomenon, however, is the tornado's weaker sister, the hell-raising, rambunctious, exhilarating Great Plains thunderstorm. One has to experience such a thunderstorm, preferably while lying scared to death in a ditch, to fathom the magnificent power of creation. In Texas, where the tropical flows are still saturated with moisture when they clash with colder air, a parade of thunderstorms dumped 30 inches of rain in 24 hours in the spring of 1978, far more rain than West Texas normally receives in a year. In Colorado, 6- and 7-inch storms have been known on the plains, and since the natural groundwater is sparse, the flooding that results is spectacular. In 1964, such a flood occurred in the Bijou Creek watershed, 80 miles east of Denver. Most of the time, Bijou Creek is less a creek than a dry wash. One has to search to find a puddle. During that storm, however, the Bijou became the second largest river in the United States, carrying 465,000 cubic feet per second off the barren plains. Don Christensen was there. "It was the most unbelievable son of a bitch you ever saw," he says. The Bijou rose in a few hours and was almost dry a day later. A phantom monster. But the damage downstream was done. Bijou Creek enters the South Platte from the south, exactly at the site of Narrows Dam. Upriver, the Platte is well controlled. The main untamed tributary below Fort Collins and the main cause of damage downstream is Bijou Creek. The dam site is flexible enough so that one can more or less choose to put the dam in front of the Bijou confluence or behind it. If the dam goes in upstream for the Bijou conference, obviously, most of the flood control benefits are lost. Originally, the Bureau was intent on capturing the Bijou behind Narrows Dam because the economics of the project would automatically improve, greater flood control benefits could be claimed, and a much larger proportion of the dam's cost would be non-reimbursable. Flood control, however, has always been the province of the Corps of Engineers, and the Corps, not the Bureau, would have to decide whether capturing the Bijou was worth it, or for that matter, whether it was even safe to try to contain it. The decision was to be made in 1965, shortly after Narrows was reauthorized by Congress and the Bureau began to push it seriously. On July 14, 1965, in a confidential letter to Commissioner Dominey, Pat Dugan, who had just left California to become the Bureau's regional director in Denver, described his efforts to ensure a decision that controlling the Bijou was worthwhile. Having just attended a meeting of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, Dugan reported, I stressed the necessity for an early answer from the Corps of Engineers on the benefits to be provided for control of Bijou Creek by extension of the dam. The board strongly expressed themselves as being in favor of this facet of the Narrows project, and I'm confident that the Corps will be under continued pressure to provide the necessary answer. Unfortunately for the Bureau, the pressure to provide the necessary answer came to naught. The Bijou flooded mightily, but it flooded most infrequently, the Corps decided, so controlling it wasn't worth the extra cost. There was also some question as to whether another 450,000 cubic feet per second flood might not take out the dam. With most of its flood control rationale gone, Narrows went into eclipse during the remainder of the 1960s. In the early 1970s, however, the tide of fortune changed. Wayne Aspinall, the chairman of the House Interior Committee, was growing old and politically vulnerable, and Narrows, it seemed, was to be his swan song. The imperious old schoolteacher began pushing it so relentlessly that he even refused to let the project's opponents testify before his House Interior Committee. At the same time, the first OPEC oil crisis hit, and everyone began eyeing Colorado's huge reserves of oil shale. Some Coloradans seemed to want to turn the state into an energy colony and grow rich off it. Others wanted to lock up as much water as possible so the oil, coal, and uranium industries would be forced to remain relatively small and the state's rural character, what was left of it, would remain fairly intact. One of the main adherents of the latter view was the new governor, Richard D. Lamb. An even stronger adherent was his commissioner of natural resources, Harris Sherman. The fact that Narrows was nowhere near the shale oil and uranium was somehow lost. What mattered was giving the state's unappropriate water to agriculture and locking it up as best one could, now and forever. As Midas turned everything he touched into gold, the Narrows project had a miraculous ability to turn everyone it touched into someone else. It turned a crew-cut, raw-bone young farmer like Don Christensen into an environmentalist. It turned a handsome young environmentalist like Senator Gary Hart into an avid water developer. Above all, it turned perhaps the three most powerful men in Colorado into bitter enemies. One of the three was Glenn Saunders, the chief counsel for the Denver Water Board. A brilliant man with a silver tongue, Saunders had, for more than 30 years, been the water lawyer in a state where water lawyers wield power that makes them objects of profound respect. Under his tutelage, the Denver Water Board had become a kind of understudy of the Metropolitan Water District of Los Angeles, a well-oiled, well-funded, supra-political machine trying to purloin water from every corner of the state, all in the interest of turning Denver into the Los Angeles of the Rockies, a goal which has been largely achieved. In a strictly legal sense, of course, the Water Board didn't steal water, but cross the Front Range and go into the mountains, where most of Colorado's water originates, and the response to a mention of the Denver Water Board is likely to be an oath. Saunders was the perfect symbol of this rough-and-tumble political machine. With his Dickensian visage, in his checked suits and pastel shirts and vivid ties, he was the city sharpie making ruthless inroads into the virgin Old West, terrifying witnesses in the docket, shouting down citizens at public hearings, and always scheming, pushing, plotting for more dams. The second of the three men was Clarence J. Kuiper, who through the most of the 1970s served as Colorado state engineer. In a state such as Colorado, where both ground and surface water are regulated and everyone wants more than there is, the state engineer is a combination of judge, jury, and cop. He decides what is a reasonable diversion to each farm. He decides who can put in a well and how much he can pump. He decides when a diverter can no longer divert during a drought and when a pumper can no longer pump. He makes sure enough water reaches neighboring states to satisfy compact agreements, and in the course of making such decisions, he wins the wrath, and if he does his job honestly and well, as Kuiper did, the grudging admiration of every water user in the state. Kuiper's whole life had been spent in water development, first as a young engineer in Turkey, for whose government the Bureau was building dams, later as a consulting engineer for the state of Wyoming, for which he drew up a water plan, and finally as Colorado's Viceroy of Water. A gigantic man whose ponderous gait and basso profundo voice belie a quick and encompassing intellect, Kuiper was light years from being a conservationist. He was a water developer and an admirer of Ronald Reagan. He was enough of a Westerner to call Jimmy Carter's water projects hit list and act of war, even if in private he referred to most of the projects in question as dogs. Kuiper never stood in the path of a water project unless it was a project in another state that threatened his own state supply. But that would change. The third man was the governor of Colorado, Richard Lamb. Young, humorless, thoughtful, intense, prematurely silver-haired, Lamb was a prototype of the New Age politician. As a state legislator, he had made a name as an environmentalist, and a rather bold one. He was the leader of the successful effort to keep the lucrative Winter Olympics out of Denver. In 1978, the Almanac of American Politics described him as far out. He flew periodically to Chicago or New York to hobnob with people like Garrett Hardin, the ecologist, and Hazel Henderson, the futurist, who served with him on the National Board of the Council on Population and Environment. He staffed his administration with left-leaning people in their 20s and 30s, people like Harris Sherman, his resources secretary, who had served as counsel to the Environmental Defense Fund. Lamb was the sort of politician one could imagine drinking Redzinger tea amid the whiskey swillers in the smoke-filled rooms. He had backpacks and bicycles in his garage, and his wife, Dottie, was a well-known feminist. From every chamber of commerce in every mean little Colorado town, there arose a collective groan. Dick Lamb, the governor? But Lamb already had a reputation, in some circles, as a rather shameless opportunist, and even at the apogee of his alleged radicalism, he never was known as someone who didn't like water projects. In 1975, when Don Christensen and his Weldon Valley Landowners Group went shopping for a lawyer to represent them in what they were sure could culminate in a legal battle with the Bureau of Reclamation, they decided they had better choose well. "Everyone we talked to said, 'You want the best? Go hire Glenn Saunders,'" Christensen remembers. "I said, 'Glenn Saunders? Hell! Name one dam he's ever opposed. He isn't going to bother with a bunch of farmers like us.' Well, we went to see him anyway. At first he looked like he couldn't wait for us to go back out the door. But we served it up to him straight, and that man listened to us. You could watch his prejudices dissolve. I mean, he was a lawyer first and foremost, and he knew we had a case." Here was this bunch of farmers marching in here saying they wanted to stop Narrows Dam, a raspy voice Saunders recounted. "I said to them, 'Stop Narrows Dam? We don't want that. We want to get everything we can built.' But they kept throwing facts at me, and they finally had me convinced Narrows is a boondoggle. When I took a closer look at it, it was an even bigger boondoggle than they said." "Old Saunders had sort of half agreed to represent us," Christensen recalls, "but I think he still wanted to hear what the Bureau had to say. So he ups and says, 'Get your coats, we're going out to see the Bureau.' Just like that. We drove out there to the Bureau's big box of a headquarters, Mr. Saunders and Marvin Etchison, our president, and me. Saunders knew just the man to see. We walked into the bureaucrat's office, I can't remember who he was, and sat down like we owned it. I was tickled. Mad as I was at the Bureau, I never would have done something like that. And Mr. Saunders and this Bureau guy got into an argument right away. I don't even know about what, But the bureau guy said, "Well, Mr. Saunders, you of all people should know that." Christensen is given to explosions of laughter, and the recollection makes him almost giddy. "You should know the answer to that." Saunders doesn't say another word. He was mad. He gets up and kind of calmly says to Marvin and me, "Come on, Marvin and Don. We can accomplish nothing further here." And out we went, just like we came in. In the car, Saunders says, "I want you to go back to the Weldon Valley and start raising a kitty of $100,000. That's what it's going to cost you to fight your government." $100,000. You could have licked me if I thought we could raise that kind of money from a little old bunch of farmers. In plotting their strategy, the Weldon Valley landowners group had made one crucial mistake. They had always assumed that their main fight would be with the Bureau, the Colorado Water Conservation Board, a Chamber of Commerce for dams, and the Lower South Platte Conservancy District, which was scheduled to receive water from Narrows. The Lower South Platte Conservancy District was led by two brothers, Dave and Don Hamill, both influential in state and national politics. Dave Hamill had run unsuccessfully for governor and was a former administrator of the Rural Electrification Administration. If Narrows was built, the Hamills would probably be the chief violators of the Reclamation Act in its service area, for they owned several thousand acres there. But as it turned out, the Bureau and the Lower South Platte people were merely a major and minor irritant. The really tough opposition came from the person they had originally counted on for help, Colorado Governor Dick Lamb. What had happened to Lamb, the one-time radical environmental legislator? His former friend Alan Merson, who beat Wayne Aspinall in the Democratic primary in 1972, lost the general election, and ended up as regional administrator for the EPA, thought he had his finger on it. Lamb got religion rather late in life, Merson told an interviewer. Once a political aspirant gets elected, he finds he has this strange new dilemma. Rather than worrying about what people want to hear, he has to worry about what they want to have. There's a big difference. People move out here because of the Rocky Mountains, but if some huge hand came down and swept away the Rocky Mountains, a lot of them wouldn't even notice. They're too busy getting rich. Well, Dick Lamb was elected in the middle of the biggest boom in this state's history. He saw that the great big capitalist machine creating all the filth and ugliness and pollution was also making his constituents fat and sleek and happy. He came to feel that he had slighted the capitalist machine, which suddenly seemed to him to be working miracles. I mean, you look out from the Capitol dome, and all you see is brown, inhospitable plains on the one side and ice-covered mountains on the other. It looks like a tough place, but the capitalist machine was scratching phenomenal wealth out of it. At some point, Lamb realized that the whole damn machine runs on the impoundment of water, so he said, "By God, we'd better impound some more water." "It isn't just Lamb," Merson went on disgustedly. "The whole congressional delegation, except for Pat Schroeder, a young Democratic congresswoman from Denver, is on the run from the irrigators. But just those who are lucky enough to be sucking off the big federal teat, Gary Hart, Floyd Haskell, Tim Wirth, I like them all, they're my friends, but they're all scared to death of not liking water enough. This state is booming like crazy, and we're running out of water. So politicians tend to go blind in office. They're for any water project. They don't care how bad it is. At EPA, we tried to start a permit program for salinity discharges," Merson went on. "Some of these irrigators are poisoning rivers all the way to the ocean, returning water that's 20 times saltier than when they take it out. I explained it to Dick, and he said, 'You're right, it's a good plan, but I can't support it. The legislature will kill me over it. God damn it, this could be another Interstate 470. I'll lose.'" "That was what really bothered him," Merson said. "I'll lose. I took it to Harris Sherman, and he said, 'It's unconstitutional, illegal, and immoral, and it will hurt agriculture.'" Agriculture was key in Lamb's and Sherman's thinking, because what they wanted even more than growth was stable growth. In 125 years, Colorado's economy had boomed and busted more than that of any other state, except, perhaps, Nevada. Nevada had introduced stable industries, gambling, prostitution, marriage, divorce. In Colorado, the only industry that had filled the fearful troughs between the boom cycles when it looked as if the state might be virtually abandoned was agriculture. It represented stability. Late in the 20th century, it had also come to represent something else. Unlike eastern states, which can keep out development only by passing laws, western states have a natural means of halting industries they don't want at their gates, a scarcity of water. In the early 1970s, Colorado became the first western state that actually wanted to keep an industry out, or at least keep it from overwhelming its economy and way of life. The industry was energy, especially oil shale, and the means of holding back its growth was to try to put the remaining water in agriculture's hands and let the energy companies worry about wresting it away, or let them import water from somewhere else, as Exxon was proposing to run an aqueduct from Owyhee Reservoir in South Dakota. C.J. Kuiper, on the other hand, was charged with putting water to beneficial use, and it seemed silly to him to waste tens of thousands of acre-feet on crops with a low economic return, crops which were subsidized by the reclamation program and, in the case of some, federal price supports, when half of America's oil was now coming out of the Middle East. Privately, Kuiper believed oil shale development was necessary. Philosophically, he believed in the doctrine of highest use. Water had become so scarce in Colorado that whoever could pay the most should get what remained. Reclamation farmers paid the least of anyone. Such thinking, however, was ultimately to have very little to do with the position Kuiper took on the Narrows Project. His position rested on his growing conviction that Narrows, if built, wouldn't even be able to hold water, that it would never be able to deliver the water it promised, and that there was a very real possibility the dam would collapse. Never, since Narrows was first authorized in 1944, had anyone suggested that it might sit on an unsafe site. How much on-site testing the Bureau did prior to the 1970s is unknown. Its main concern seemed to be drumming up enough local support to overwhelm the opposition. But by 1976, it had its first sizable appropriation in hand and finally decided it ought to learn something about the geology of the narrow site. One morning in the summer of that year, Corky Tomke, a neighbor of Don Christensen's and a leader in the battle against the dam, noticed that the Bureau had a man with a drilling gig down by the South Platte. Tomke wandered over to say hello. The man announced that he was drilling core samples to see what the foundation of the dam was like. Tomke asked him what he had found so far. "Well, don't quote me," the driller answered, "but this site has big problems." "Big problems?" "Big problems. There's bedrock down there somewhere, but I can't find it. I've drilled 250 feet down and still haven't hit it. All I get is gravel and loose rock and sand." "What do you suppose that means?" Tomke asked. "It means," the Bureau man drawled, "that this dam is going to have a hell of a time holding water. The foundation is like a coffee filter, but don't tell him I told you that." Tomke swore that he wouldn't. Then he walked casually back to his truck and gunned it over the bumpy road toward Don Christensen's place. "As soon as Corky told me what he heard," Christensen recalled, "we called up our congressman, Jim Johnson. He was 100% for the dam, but we figured this was a piece of news. We got his assistant on the line. I can't even remember what his name is. Well, he sounded real concerned on the phone. He told me, 'I'll talk to the congressman and get right back to you.' I wished I'd had a tape recorder on that damn line. He never got back to me. No, sir. And the next day, wouldn't you believe it, that well driller was not back on the job. They handcuffed him to a desk in Denver somewhere. He never came back again." "It was about then," Christensen said, "that we decided to see the state engineer." The point at which Christensen decided to pay a call on the state engineer coincided nicely with the collapse of Teton Dam. Teton, as Kuiper put it, scared the living bleep out of Lamb and Harris Sherman. Both of them watched poor Cecil Andrus face the reporters on the news and saw his hapless water resources director, Keith Higginson, blamed for a tragedy he had little to do with. Andrus had been lukewarm at most about the Teton project. What if a damn Lamb and Sherman strongly backed wiped out a string of Colorado towns? After Teton Dam went, Sherman decided he had better review the safety questions surrounding any imminent project planned for Colorado. When Sherman called this meeting, I was just leaving on a trip, Kuiper recalls. I had never paid much attention to the Narrows. I'm not required to in the case of a federal project. I knew the ancient Platte River left a great big alluvial bed and that the Bureau would have to get through a lot of alluvial wash to anchor the dam on anything solid. But I figured they knew what to do. I could have walked into Sherman's meeting and said, "Well, I know of a few problems with the site, but I deferred to the Bureau's expertise." After Teton, good Lord, I didn't imagine that the Bureau was going to let something that stupid happen again. But, Kuiper figured, he was the state engineer. If a dam failed, and he had assayed the site, he would share in the blame no matter who deserved it. Besides, Sherman had asked for his opinion, and he might as well give an informed one. Therefore, as he left to go on his trip, he asked his assistants, in his absence, to prepare a schematic of the narrow site, superimposing the dam over a big color diagram of what was known of the geologic conditions. When he got back, he had only a few minutes to look over the schematic. A few minutes was all he needed. "I looked at that schematic," Kuiper said, "and in 30 seconds I saw why that test driller was right. The old alluvial bed of that ancient river is huge. There are about 10 stories of gravel out there, sitting on 5 stories of cobblestones. Way off on the south end of the site, the alluvial bed is almost 300 feet deep. Well, they can't clean all that stuff out. It would be much too expensive, and God knows where they'd even put it. So they were just going to let the dam sit on top of the alluvium, not really anchored to rock except at the abutments. And the alluvium ran under the south abutment. To prevent seepage under the dam, they had a cut-off trench planned down to bedrock, sort of like the Keyway trench they built at Teton. But basically, they were just going to hang it under the dam like a curtain. Hell, that alluvium is so wide they've got to run that trench out on the south side, way beyond the dam, or water is going to creep around it, exactly the way it did at Teton. It looked to me, from the schematic, that they were going to have to extend it out a mile. Well, no way they were planning to do that. It would cost too much. I sat there staring at the schematic, Kuiper said. And I said to myself, here we go again. Doesn't the Bureau even know how to learn from a disaster? Even if the seepage didn't re-enter the dam immediately, which was what apparently happened at Teton, Kuiper guessed that the rate of water seepage would be so enormous that the reservoir would more or less disappear and emerge somewhere downriver as a swamp. But where? The water would back up behind the dam, penetrate the porous reservoir bottom, and sneak around the cutoff trench, underground. Then, following the downslope of the plains, it would have to resurface at about the same elevation. That elevation coincided approximately with the town of Fort Morgan, population 8,000, which lay 15 miles downriver. If they build the dam, Kuiper said sardonically, those Fort Morganites had better learn how to swim. When Kuiper walked into Harris Sherman's meeting, he was surprised to see his sometime nemesis, Glenn Saunders, smiling at him. Saunders had somehow caught wind of the gathering and had demanded admittance. Sherman, who could hardly have wandered him there, hadn't dared bar him. One did not invite the antipathy of the preeminent lawyer in Colorado. Sherman opened the meeting by asking each of the assembled members to state flatly whether they had any misgivings about the narrow site. "The site's fine," said the Bureau geologist. "The site's fine," said Felix Sparks, the head of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. "The site's fine," said the state geologist. Everyone else had the same answer, except Kuiper. "Well," said Kuiper, "I might have agreed with you until 10 minutes ago when I saw the schematic my staff prepared for me. Maybe you should have a look at it, too." Sherman looked pained. "What are you saying, Coop?" he demanded. "I'm saying that looking at that schematic gave me some serious reservations about the narrow site," Kuiper said. "From the looks of it, there could be major leakage right under the dam. If it were a non-federal project, I'd never approve it." Sherman, watching Saunders and Don Christensen, whom the lawyer had brought with him, cackling silently behind closed lips, was incensed. "On what basis do you say that? Why do you say that?" Kuiper then laid out what the schematic had told them. Sherman acted as if he hadn't heard a word of it. "I don't care about your schematic," he finally interrupted. "I want to see a lengthy memo on all of this. You've made some very serious charges in the presence of two people who will obviously use them against this dam. You had better be right." Kuiper stood up to his full 6'6" and glowered at Sherman, who was at least 25 years younger. "Young man, you'll get your lengthy memorandum," he growled, "but don't you tell me what I'd better be." Then he stalked out of the room. Kuiper had hardly finished his memorandum later that day when he received calls from both Saunders and the Rocky Mountain News, which had obviously been put onto the story by Saunders, asking whether they could have a copy. The news reporter also wanted to take a look through his Narrows file. As a public servant, Kuiper had no other choice than to keep his files open, except on matters involving national security. He was also legally obligated to make public any document he wrote, including the Sherman memo. He invited both Saunders and the reporter to come over. The reporter from the news was just taking the file to an empty desk when Sherman stalked into Kuiper's office. "What is he doing here?" Sherman demanded, pointing at the reporter. Kuiper said he had given him permission to look through the file. Sherman was aghast. "I haven't even had a chance to look at it," he protested. "Well, he asked first," said Kuiper. Sherman looked as if he were ready to throw a punch. He walked over to the reporter and grabbed the sheaf of files. "I'm looking through these first," he said, plopping the stack on an empty desk as the reporter stood by, dumbfounded. In Kuiper, Sherman had a messenger whom he couldn't kill, and when he tried, he seemed only to wound himself. After the incident with the reporter, the state attorney general removed Kuiper's Narrows file for safekeeping because of a lawsuit pending over the issue. Kuiper insists he did not ask him to do it, but Sherman evidently thought he had. The whole thing reflected badly on him, because it looked as if the attorney general thought someone might pilfer materials from the file, and the person who would have seemed to have the best motive, the person most ardently in favor of Narrows, was Sherman himself. Sherman was enraged. He immediately wrote Kuiper a long memorandum impugning, implicitly or explicitly, his integrity, his motives, his sense of judgment, and even his competence as an engineer. Because he was about to leave town, Sherman dictated the memo and asked his assistant, Jerry Shagstad, to sign it. After reading the memo, Kuiper sat down and wrote a blistering one of his own, which he walked downstairs and threw on Shagstad's desk. 10 minutes later, Shagstad rushed into his office and demanded that he retract what he had said. Kuiper refused. When Sherman returned and heard what had happened, he came storming into Kuiper's office. "You're being insubordinate," he yelled at Kuiper. "I'm going to take disciplinary action against you. You are going to regret this." Kuiper stood up and went chest to nose with Sherman, who was a full head shorter. "I'm civil service," he thundered. "You can't discipline me without cause, but I hope you try. I'll blow you right out of the water, young man." It seemed that nothing could change Dick Lamb's and Harris Sherman's minds about Narrows. Not the plight of the Weldon Valley, not the state engineer's misgivings about the safety of the dam site, not the Teton disaster, not even the fact, which became an issue again after Kuiper's skepticism was reported in the press, that there was an alternative to the narrow site. It was an alternative that appeared to be safer, that would inundate a cow feedlot instead of homes, churches, and graves, and that made as little or as much economic sense as the Narrows project. 25 miles upriver toward Greeley, the Hardin site had been under consideration for years as an alternative to Narrows. It was not authorized by Pick Sloan, mainly because it would have cost slightly more to build. In other highly important respects, however, it was the superior site. The main improvement within the taking area was the Joseph Monfort feedlot, the largest cattle feeding operation in the world. Qualifying improvement is especially advised here, because the Monfort feedlot, 100,000 cows on a couple of thousand acres, was an insult to all five senses. Its downwind neighbors found themselves wishing wistfully that they could replace it with a paper mill. one of the largest sources of non-point pollution in the country, the feedlot would sooner or later run into the Clean Water Act and might be shut down for good. Rumor had it that Joe Montfort would be happy to have someone pay him to take it off his hands.